should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loves himself. For no man ever yet hateth his own flesh, but he nourishes it and he cherishes it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body and of his flesh and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. Father, we thank you again for this time. And Lord, we thank you for this incredible gift you've given to us in marriage. Lord, to have somebody to share our life with. And Lord, to know deeper and richer and stronger than any other being in the world. And Lord, because of the depths of it and because of so much about it that is so complicated, because it does involve virtually, as the years go by, every area and aspect of our life and our being, Lord, it's sometimes quite challenging. But Lord, I pray that we would be ones that, as great as the challenge, would also be the work of your Spirit within us. Lord, that you could humble us and teach us and strengthen us. Lord, that we would watch through the years our love blossom and continue to grow. And whatever we defined the word love at years ago, we now use the same word, but the definition is so much richer and deeper and stronger. And so, Lord, teach us these things. Minister to us, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, here once again, just to remind ourselves briefly, we're talking about, you know, two people here filled with the Spirit, with a joy within their heart, a gratitude within their life, and a submission. And they're looking at one another, and we are given these roles. Now, in these roles, you know, they're ones that, as I already said, has nothing to do with ability, capacity. Nothing to do with personal, you know, anything other than God just simply looks at a man and he said, you will learn. I will be working in your life with the challenges of learning to lead. And therefore, the wife will submit to her husband. And I will also be working in the life of both of you. Or a husband, I'm going to teach you how to love and what it really is. Now, the interesting thing is most every man, you know, we know that we're called to lead. We know there's something, you know, about us. Even as it's interesting, I look at little children, and you look there at little boys. And I remember when my boys were just little boys, somehow or another, they knew the difference between their father and their mother. In the sense, they knew that, I mean, when I, as their father, there was an ability almost to submit easier to me, I think, a little bit, than their mother. It was almost like, hey, you're a girl. It was almost like the boys just knew, you're a girl. I'm a boy. You know, before they even understood anything of male, female in reality, there was already something almost in their the male DNA. You're a girl. I'm a boy. And you know, nobody ever accuses anybody of being a daddy's boy. But they sure will accuse somebody of being a mama's boy. You know, and somebody, you're letting a woman run your life. And men, there's something about us. We know that we are called to be head. And the tragic thing about that is that many of us, the definition and the process of headship is one that has oftentimes come through a very worldly concept, you know, of head and of control, you know, or something. We just know I'm to be head, but not knowing what it's like on God's terms to be head. We just know our own internal, or the way that we're taught in society, or how to be tough, or macho, or, you know, the man's man, or something, on what it is to be head. I know when we literally, when we were on our honeymoon, and there's something about getting married. There's something about sliding that ring on your finger. There's something about those vows it's a game changer. Not necessarily for better or worse particularly, but it does change. You walk away from that, there's a whole new sense of responsibility. There's a whole new sense now of, you know, of pressure sometimes that I don't know how it comes and why it comes, but I do know it's there. And I know when we got married, actually we were engaged, you know, for about a year, and the whole time we didn't argue. We didn't really disagree. We were ones there. In fact, we would talk about other people that we knew, you know, that, you know, Christians, and we were, you know, Christians, but we'd look at other Christians and couples, and they'd fight, and they'd argue, and they'd disagree, and we would talk about, oh, why fall in love? Why do you want to marry somebody you're going to fight with? You know, almost amazed, you know, just pray about it and forget it somehow or another. All the way through our engagement period, we had a very easy time in many ways, great agreements. on things, and we're just very, very much in love. Never fought, never had arguments with one another and things. But somehow or another, when you get married, you listen, you think different. Well, now I'm the head, now I'm the husband, or something, and you just like this spell comes over you or something that is, it's my job, or whatever. And we were literally on our honeymoon. We're in California driving up Highway 1, a beautiful highway along, the coastline there, the Pacific. And as we're driving along, a beautiful day, got in a discussion. And I don't remember what the discussion was about. I just remember we weren't agreeing, in it. And again, I don't know what the discussion was, what the opinion was. The only thing I remember clearly about it is that I was right and she was wrong on this thing. And so we're going down the road and I said something, and then she gave, another opinion, the wrong opinion, on the thing. And so I was quiet, loving, and I just corrected her. I just repeated what I'd said earlier again. And he thought, well, maybe she didn't hear it or collect it or fix it. I don't know what it was, but I'm a nice guy. And so I just repeated it. And then she then proceeded to repeat the false opinion again, the incorrect one, on the thing. And I'm kind of, what's going on here? What's happening here? And so it went back and forth a little bit, and I got very frustrated. Now, we've never been yellers or screamers or door slammers or anything, but if you were there, you'd have been impressed with this, but we're just going along the road. So I just thought, well, let's take care of this. So I just, so we just pull off the road, and we're late or have, arrive any place on our honeymoon. And so I pull off the road there, put in park, turn the key off, and then sat there and proceeded, to talk to her. And looked at, and basically I said, look, I need to clarify something here, I think. And again, if you'd have been in the car, if you'd have been sitting in the back seat, you'd have said, whoa, he's good. He's good. Because I was very calm, very collected, very gracious, very kind. Didn't raise my voice. There was no tension at all. I just very simply said, look, from now on, when I say something, that's how it is. Do you have a problem with that? I mean, what is the thing here? That's how it is. Do you get that? And I was it was firm, but very gracious, very sweet about it. At which time, Jean, she looks over at me and realizes what I just said. And all of a sudden, we're just looking there, and in a moment, her head, it fell off of her shoulders. It just fell. Fortunately, she caught it in her hand. She caught it. And she starts sobbing. Oh, no. What have I done? It's things. I'm just sitting there, very matter of fact. And all that seemed to do for me was validate the need for this conversation. Whoa, she really needed this. Because I'm just thinking, we need to straighten this out right now. I do not want to spend the next 50 years of my life arguing. Who wants to argue for 50 years? I don't want to argue. I want to get along. And so therefore, when I say something, that's it. Case closed. Done. Finished. Easy. I don't want to spend the next 50 years being henpecked, and I hope you don't want to be a henpecker. So this will solve it. And I really, truly thought I was doing us a favor. I thought it was this is because to me, that's what my concept of headship was, is that whatever it needed to make sure that message got across. I was kind of like the story maybe you heard, of 150 years ago, this young couple, they get married and they're going off on their little, cart ride, and the donkey's pulling them off on their honeymoon. And while they're on the way, the donkey all of a sudden is in the middle of the road. It just sits down, just sat down. It was time the fella, he's like, hey, what are you doing? He reaches, pulls out the buggy whip behind, starts whipping this donkey. He says, get up. I didn't tell you to stop. Get moving. Keep going. And the donkey gets up and goes on. It's just thrashing away at this thing. And then he says, that's one. And they go on a little ways. A little while later, the donkey just stops, sits down again. The guy, She reached out, pulls out that buggy whip, whaps, whapping away at that donkey. She said, I didn't say stop. You keep moving. Get on moving. Go on. You know, the donkey gets up and goes on. He says, that's twice. You know, a little while later, the donkey sits down a third time. It was done. Now he pulls behind, pulls out his shotgun. Blows away the donkey right there. I told you, that's three. At which time the woman just goes frantic. She just loses it. She just can't believe it. And she just screams out, you know, panic, fear. You know, this whole thing, what he just done, he couldn't believe she saw it. And he looks over at her and he says, that's one. You know, but a lot of guys, they whatever they think they have to do to be head, whatever it is that to get into that role, well, that is not headship. That's just that, you know, maybe the world can teach you that. That's the way that the world is, but that's not being head. Not by the Bible. That's using power. That's using force or fear or anger or hostility or a forced subjection. When somebody does a thing like that. But that's carnal man's nature. I know I'm to be head, and because I don't know how to be head, whatever I have to do it, I will do it. I will let you know who the head of this house is. But here, Paul makes it very clear. Very clear. He says, husbands, you are the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. He doesn't leave it to me to define it how I think it is. He doesn't look at culture. He doesn't look at somebody else. He says it's defined the way that the Lord defines it. And I had to realize my definition was not correct. I remember one time years ago, we're talking, and Jean, I can't remember what brought it up. But she said something, she says, you know, sometimes I'm afraid of you. And when she said that, I said, what? You know, and she said, even the boys, I'm afraid of me. And I was truly mystified. I looked at her, in honest unbelief, I said, I can't believe you'd say that. Because I'm going back, when have I ever raised my voice? Have I ever made a fist? I never touched you. I don't slam doors. I don't throw furniture. I mean, I could look back and I honestly felt the entire, you know, all the years of marriage and have her look at me and say, sometimes I'm afraid of you. I said, why? Are you sure? Why would you say that? And she said, you have a look that you can have sometimes. And when she said that, I realized, I do. I had that, I can't do it. I wish I could, but I had that look, you know, there's a look at something that I, just like, don't push me, kind of a look, or something like, I could lose it, but I'm holding myself in control here, you know, or something. I mean, and I realized, you know, that I had that kind of a look when you'd be frustrated or something else that, and it was a very controlling look. It was a very thing there that, again, without ever having to throw anything, raise your voice. Sometimes we men, we can have ways there to where we are head, but head not as Christ is head of the church, but the head by carnal ways, by the flesh, or by our own control of this thing. But here is, we're told here very clearly, it's as Christ is the head of the church. And Jesus is the head of the church by model, by grace, by love, by patience. You look at the way that when we're looking at Jesus as the head, Jesus said in Matthew 23:11, he says, but he that is greatest among you, he will be your servant. Mark 9:23, he said unto them, if any man desire to be first, the same shall be last, and the servant of all. Jesus in Luke 22:25, he said, the kings of the Gentiles, they exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactor, but you shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger. And he that is chief, as he that doth serve. And when you stop and realize Jesus, he's head, but he's head by mercy, by grace, by kindness, by patience. By model. You know, for the last 2,000 years, Jesus has been, you know, courting his bride. In a sense, patiently, mercifully, interceding, presenting faultless. When you look at how he interprets head, he's head by saviorhood. He's head by mercy. He's head by grace. And when we as men begin to realize, you know, that when I'm called, when he says, you are head, am I head as Christ is the head of the church? And where somebody looks and says, I want that. Paul then, as he gets in verse 25, he says how this headship works out, some of the practical aspects of it, in giving us there the responsibility. Now, because you are head, he says, husbands, love your wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. And then the first thing here that we're told about a husband is that when he says, I am the head, and then he says, then the first responsibility of that headship is his headship is by love. His authority is by love. And the first thing that love actually does, he gives us a very practical aspects in things here. When a man says, I love my wife, and he doesn't leave us to define it ourselves and say, well, here's why I love her. Look at this. I got her a car. Look at this. You know, I did this or that. He says the very first thing, what it is that a wife needs from a husband, he says that he might sanctify her. And he says, when you're the head of the wife and you love your wife, that means that you sanctify her. That word sanctify, actually in the Hebrew and the Greek, the word holy, holiness, sanctify, they all essentially come from the same root word. And it means, very simply put, to set apart for sacred use. And essentially, when a husband there is to love his wife, he's loving her as Christ loved the church, and when he is sanctifying, that he takes her and he sets her aside. He puts her in an entirely different category of all of the rest of life, all of the other relationships of life, and she becomes essentially his joy and his crown. She becomes essentially to him his greatest desire. Just like Jesus, when he sanctifies his church, we are his joy and crown. We are his greatest accomplishment. We are his greatest desire. He is the one he ever lives to make intercession for us, to present us false. We are his heart. We are the center of it. And something that we as men, I don't think, understand by nature, and that's why we're having to be taught it, and that is essentially there, you know, what it is to set a wife aside and, for sacred use. How many of you kind of, when you got married, kind of got in a church marriage? You know, a tradition. Would you say you had a traditional marriage ceremony? Well, if you got married, like maybe probably in a church where, you know, your parents sat down here in the front side and then the grandparents and your friends, that's a tradition. That's English, old English, actually, ceremony, that's been in the Christian church for many years, for centuries. And essentially, what the ceremony was all about, when it was set up, the very orchestration of the ceremony itself and the way that it would work is that when you probably, if you had that or you've been to weddings, you know, in a traditional old English ceremony, there'll be, you know, where essentially, you know, the people, as they're all gathered, they're all strategically set. In other words, you will have over here the groom's, you know, mother and father, the wife's parents on the other side, then the groom's mother and, or the grandparents and the grandparents, and then the uncles and aunts. And then for the first few rows, usually they're all set aside for people specifically according to their relationship with the bride or with the groom. And they're positioned there so that her closest ones right next to her are from her parents, the grandparents, others, as they set them in, they're on this side. On his side, they're on that side. And is how people are sitting. Then when you invite people, then after that, you may have a few rows of special friends and people, you know, that are very close to you and dear friends. And then oftentimes after that, just co-workers and friends and neighbors and basically anybody who will bring a present. You know, something that, you know, to the wedding that you kind of have. But it's something when you have the ceremony, that's how it's set up. And then as the ceremony happens, you know, out comes the groom and then comes the best man and maybe in the, you know, the groomsmen, and they'll all stand there, and then they start the music, and the door opens, and then the bride's dearest friends come down, and then she'll have her friends come down, and they lie on this side until her closest friend, the maid of honor, now then she comes out and stands there, and then usually they then close the door, and then they change the music and open it up again, and now here comes the bride to the special music where now dad, you know, there with his daughter on his arm, he walks her down. Stands there, and then he turns her over to him, to the groom, and now the responsibility of life. I brought her into the world. Now you're going to carry her on from here. I'm transferring over this responsibility to you. Then he goes and he sits down, and. But then after that, after they're all seated in there, you've got the closest people all around you and strategically set. And then as you go through the vows, One of the things that I don't hear it very commonly any longer, in the old English they used to say, which we had in ours, is that part of the thing was, you know, I, John, take thee Mary to be a wedded wife, have an old blah, blah, blah. Going through that. But one of the other things that they would ask and used to, I don't hear much anymore, but forsaking all others, I pledge thee my troth. Now, did any of you say that? Nobody. See, well, that's why you're a mess today. You did not say that. But the, but we actually, in the old English, they used to do that. And we actually did that. And I had no idea what it meant. We had a rehearsal, and, you know, the night before, you know, the ceremony, you go through all this, and everybody's there, and everybody's seated. You go through the whole thing, you know, before it. And in that, we actually came up, and we went through our vows and did the whole thing, you know, and a complete, you know, rehearsal for the thing. And he had me repeat after that, the pastor. But they never really sat and explained things to you. I had no explanation. Part of our thing was, forsaking all others, I pledge thee my troth. And sure enough, in the wedding, you say that. And again, I hadn't the slightest idea what it meant. Anything, it was just part of a vow. They wanted me to say it, and basically, that day, I didn't mind anything. I'll say whatever you want to say. I'll say it. You know, I just give me the goods, and I'll say it. You know, sort of a thing. That's what I came here for. And so, whatever it is. So I did it. But I didn't realize there, that word, to me, forsaking all others, I didn't even know what a troth was. You know, my idea was, hey, if I ever get one, it's yours. You know, I don't believe I own one, but if I get one. And as far as I knew, a troth was just something a pig ate out of or something, maybe. I didn't know. But at any rate, when the word actually means troth, the word troth is Old English for fidelity. And what it is it's forsaking all others, I pledge you my fidelity. And what actually was a very important part of the whole ceremony, and the way the whole structure of it was, is that when everybody was brought in and they sat them down, and they would go through the ceremony, they'd open the doors after everybody is seated, and then the doors are open and the bride was brought down, row by row, step by step, she now passed up everybody else. Every other relationship that you had in your life, she came back, you know, your friends, your neighbors, your school buddies, you know, the co-workers, people lived down the street, then they passed up your cousins and your uncles and your aunts, and then they passed up your grandmas and your grandpas, and then they passed up your mother and your father, and then they passed up the bridesmen and the grooms, or bridesmaids and the groomsmen, and the best man, and then she stands right there, front row, center, above all else, and the statement was being made, is say, today, forsaking all others, I am now pledging to you my fidelity. In other words, what it meant is that from this point on, you now take front row, center in my life. And I'm asking everybody else in the congregation, move back one row. Step back, whatever our relationship up till this day, this person has surpassed you. This person is now my friends, God bless you, my buddies, my co-workers, cousins, uncles, aunts, grandmas, grandpas, mom and dad. I'm forsaking my mother and my father, I'm cleaving to my wife. She is now taking the central place in my life. That's what it means to sanctify. When somebody sanctifies, they look there and say, you are now central. You have now become the person. There are many other people, but you are the person that is in my life. And I think most people, when we get married, at least to me, I didn't understand that. I had no comprehension, you know, that I was really making a decision like that. All I knew is I was in love. I wanted a wife. I didn't have a wife. I needed a wife. And this was a great one. You're on. You know, but in the sense there of still with all of my other relationships, they stayed very, very much the same. There was no change in them. As a matter of fact, when we came home, we got married during Christmas of our senior year in college. We came home, we're both going to school and busy, and yet at the same time, I had a couple things that I did. And on Monday night, after we get married, I'm walking out the door. You know, and as I'm walking out the door, I've got my little gym bag with me. And as I'm going out, Jean looks at me when I'm going out. She says, where are you going? And, you know, you know how to do that. It's kind of like this, you know, where are you going? There's a question to it, but it's also a combination question statement like, Where do you think you're going? You know, so, you know, I mean, you know how to do it. I mean, it's all, you learn, it's there. But where are you going? And I said, well, the guys, it's volleyball. It's Monday night. And one of the things all the way through our engagement, all the way through, I mean, I had a bunch of guys, we on Monday night, we played volleyball together. A friend of mine, he had a sand volleyball court at his house. We love volleyball. We were playing. And nothing new about this. Nothing new. I didn't spring any change whatsoever in my life on this thing. It's Monday night. I'm doing the routine. I'm walking out the door, going what I've, you know, where I've been going. I did not all of a sudden change a thing. And she looks there like she says something to me like, "Where are you going?" And I said, "What do you mean? It's Monday night. Like, hello. Where do you think I'm going? You know, I got my gym bag. I'm going all the way through. You knew this. There's no cheating. Nothing changed here." But all of a sudden, I feel like something's changed. I feel like, you know, she's messing with my head. The way she'd say, you know, I mean, I'm driving away. You know you're in trouble when you're driving away and you're talking to her still. What do you mean, where am I going? You know where I'm going. And you're explaining the whole thing. You're going over it. Like, what are you doing to me? You know, and you're doing this whole thing. I mean, it really bothered me. You know, oh, for only 4 or 5 minutes, I got over it quick. But it was something that it's still there. I mean, I let it go, but that bothered me. You know, so I go on and play volleyball. Well, Thursday night, I'm walking out the door again, gym bag in hand. And again, where are you going? What do you mean where I'm going? Thursday night, again, all the way through, nothing new about this. I happened at the time, you don't hear of the game anymore, but handball. It was a huge thing, and when I played a lot of handball through college, and I loved handball. And at the Y, at the YMCA, there was a group of us, we played handball. I'm going out on Thursday, it's Thursday night. That was my handball night. Monday night, it's volleyball, it's Thursday night, you know, handball night. I'm going out the door. Where are you going? He said, well, it's Thursday night. I'm going to play volleyball. I mean, handball. You know, okay. Have a nice time. Like, you know, like, don't you dare have a nice time. You know how to say all this stuff where, you know, it's a reverse psychology thing where you say it, but it's quite clear. You do not mean this. But at any rate, have a nice time while I'm home alone, doing nothing, wondering where you are, trying to figure out what to do, waiting for you to return, and maybe not, you know, or something, you know, and how you're going through this. But so off I go. And then one morning I wake up. And as I wake up, she had kind of pulled the pillow over her head a little bit. And under the pillow was the biggest knife we owned. Yes. Terrible. I'm looking there and I see this knife under her pillow. Gene, there's a knife in bed. What are you doing with a knife in bed? And she wakes, she says, oh, I'm sorry. You know, and I said, well, what's a knife doing in bed? I could have wanted to kiss you and cut my lips off. And what are you doing with this thing? I mean, I'm upset with her. And she says, you know, a lot of these nights you're not here. And I hear noises outside and I get a little bit afraid. And so I'll put a knife there, you know, in bed. And then when I hear you drive up, I take the knife and I put it, you know, over under the bed, you know, and stuff. And she said, I guess I didn't wake up when you came in last night. At which time I got upset. I said, what are you doing? You do not need a knife. Trust God, woman. You're a Christian woman. He'll take care of you. And I'm upset with her, kind of over this thing. But the thing is that we're going through this, and I'm wondering, why do women mess with you like this? Why do they do this to you? And then you get married and they change everything on you. And it was okay when I did all this before, but now I feel bad about it. But then it took me a while to realize she didn't change anything. I changed it. I walked her. When she walked down the aisle, I told her, you are now beyond everybody else. You are now more important than everybody else. You have now walked past everybody else. And yet I came right back home from our honeymoon and just put her somewhere in the audience. A lot of wives, they never know where they sit. They never know. They're waiting for their husband. Who's ahead of them now? Is it the job? Is it their friends? Is it their buddy? Is it the guys over here? Is it some sport? Is it this or that? And they're always moving. You know, do I move? Do I sit here now? No, you can move up here. You can sit here now. Yeah, say, okay, no, move back now. So and so. And they're always feeling, you know, insecure. And they're always trying to figure out, where do I fit with you? I remember one time my wife, she's listening to me on the telephone. I didn't know it, but she was. And she's listening to me on the telephone. And afterwards, she said, you know, I like to listen to you sometimes on the telephone. And I did talk to your friends. I said, why? She said, because I find out more about what you're thinking. You know, sometimes you don't tell me anything and I'll listen to you on your friends. You know, and I find out more about you. It was time I got upset. Well, that was a private conversation, woman. What are you doing listening to my private conversations? You know, stuff. I'm almost kind of like, she's there trying to figure out where does she fit with me in our relationship. And not realizing that the role of a husband is there to sanctify his wife. That where he looks at her and says, you are now front row center. Everybody else steps back. Everybody else is after you from now on. I grew up in one home basically till I got married. I had the same friends all the way through my life. And now all of a sudden when we get married, and Jean is kind of having to compete with all of these lifelong relationships. These friends, they were like brothers to me when we were so close and things. And now she's trying to, where do I fit with your friends? And it's the husband's job to realize you are now ahead of them. You are now, and what, where I am and what I'm doing, you know, is now very important to me that it pleases you. And we are together on this. I mean, one of the things through the years, now basically all my friends divorced me. You know, they move away. They took other jobs. They moved to other states. Can't believe it, you know, to do a thing like that to me. But I mean, you know, over time, you lose your friends. I've done funerals of my friends. They go. But Gene hasn't. And when you want somebody there that you want to say, I want to have you the rest of my life. Friends will come and go. Relationships will come and go. They'll be very dear to me, perhaps, but none like you. And you are not here to compete with them. And only a husband can do that. A wife can't fight for it. Only a husband can give it to her and realize this is your relationship. And this is where you are. And how important it is that a husband does that and where the wife knows that. I remember, you know, one time, we hadn't been married a long time, but Jean, she looked at me, she's so loving. She's so different than me in so many ways, but the way, so open and things. But she looks at me one time, we're talking, and she has this real cute smile on her face. She says, you know something? And she says to me, you're my best friend. And for some reason, when she said that, it totally caught me off guard. I wasn't prepared. I didn't even know how to answer it. Actually, when she said that, I thought to myself, what? I'm your best, like, you poor thing. You know, or something. I mean, it was almost like she was waiting for, she said for me, like I was to look back and say, and you're my best friend too, you know, or something, isn't this? You know, or something, you know, I don't know what it was, but I'm just thinking to myself, I remember thinking, wait, you think, hold it. Do you think when I married you, I needed another friend? I had a bunch of friends. I didn't need any more friends. I needed a woman. Now just go on and be the woman, okay, you know, or something, and didn't know how to catalog that, how to categorize that, or saying, I want you to be my best friend. I want to build that relationship. And a husband there, that's his job, to look there and to sanctify his wife. Secondly, he says that he might cleanse her. And then a second thing that I don't think we, you know, when the Bible tells us to do things, are things we know naturally or easily do. Just, he tells us, has to teach a wife to submit because I don't think wives naturally do it. Naturally understand it. That's what we have to be taught as women. And I think husbands, we don't naturally know how to love. We don't know naturally how to sanctify. We don't naturally know how to cleanse. How we lead and run, you know, it's not our nature to do it. God has to teach you. No, headship is like Christ, not the way you think of it. You got to change that. He says, and they sanctify. You got to change that. You thought you just picked up another person on the travels of life. No, you didn't. This is more than that. Oh, really? Yeah, sanctify her. And then he has to teach her, by the way, cleanse her. Cleanse her. You cleanse her. And here, you know, the point here of it is that I don't think a woman should ever feel so clean, so loved, so accepted, so adored, so washed as she does in her husband's presence. A woman should never feel so right as she does there. And I think by nature, a lot of us men, we almost are the opposite. Many wives, they never feel they measure up. They never feel they do things good enough. You know, it's all instead of a husband just blown away by how wonderful they are. Honey, you're great. I love you. You're awesome. You know, and oftentimes husbands are the wife could cook better. Cook better. You know, it was okay. Yeah, it was dinner. It was okay. I didn't die. I'm not throwing up. You know, or something, but there's all these little ways of you could do better. You could dress better. You could look prettier. You could be sexier. You could clean the house better. This, and it's always motivation by dirt, almost. Motivation by failure. And a lot of women, they just feel like their husbands, you know, are, instead of feeling the most loved and adored and the cleanest around them, is when oftentimes they feel just the worst. Just the opposite. And I think the world teaches us that psychology. You know, it's like a coach. I went through, grew up playing sports, and the coach is always, hey, that was all right, but, man, if you'd work a little harder, commit, stay out a little longer, do a little bit more, you could do better at that. It was almost a lot of, dads motivate their sons by, hey, but you missed this spot over here. You know, hey, you look at those weeds over there. Look at this. You know, instead of seeing what you did and congratulating you on a great job, oftentimes they've got to find what's missing or what's wrong. In many of us, you know, you go to work, you got coaches, you got parents or whatever. It's almost you learn acceptability by failure and how you could measure up if you really want to go the extra mile. Well, a lot of husbands, we can be that way with our wife. And instead of making them clean and loved and adored and accepted, you know, they never quite do it quite right. And I think to me one of the tragic things today is, I mean, I feel so sorry for women, to be quite honest with you. I mean, today particularly, I don't know what's happened with Paris and Rome and London and everything, but when you got to stay young for one thing. Women, the pressure to stay young, to look young, to feel young, to dress young. You know, there's a store in California, it's called Forever 21 or something like that. You know, like women. You know, you see a 90-year-old woman in there going into Forever 21. What's wrong with this picture? You know, or something where people are, you know, the pressure. You can't get old if you're a woman. There's a new law out. I don't know who passed it, but it's been passed. You can't get old. And also, you don't get heavy. If you gain weight and get old, that's a double whammy. You know, sort of a thing. You can't. There's a law against that, against all womanhood, and the pressure, you know, that there is. And now you can't stop Hollywood. You can't stop Paris and Rome and all the billboards and the ads on TV. But a husband can look and say, "I love you. I love you just the way you are." And here I look today, I mean, so many women, the pressure again to stay young and to stay, you know, looking young and being young. I remember when I was growing up, people got old. In my generation, I remember very, very, very well my grandparents. When my grandparents were in their 50s, they were old. They were really old people. They dressed old, walked old, talked old, acted old, did everything old. You go over to their house, there's old people here. They didn't care. Yes, we're old. We're getting older. We're grandparents. And I mean, I remember my grandmothers in their 50s. They were old. They were grandmas. They were bona fide card-carrying grandmothers. They joined an institution. We are now grandmothers, and didn't bother them at all. I mean, I remember my grandma. I don't see it any longer. My grandmothers. They had blue hair. Blue hair. Where did that come from? It was almost like if you're a grandma, you go down to the blue hair store and you get blue hair. I need some blue hair now. I'm not a grandma. I'm getting older. It was an admission of age or something. I don't know what it was. And then there was a grandma's clothing store. Grandma's, when you're a grandma, you went to, I don't know where the clothing store was, but it was there. I can remember my grandmother's. Their dresses, they're all like the same. They had these little teeny flower print dresses. You know, things. She remember those? And then they were all trimmed like with white doily stuff around them, you know, or something like a tablecloth stuff or whatever it was. But they dressed old. I remember, of course, when you're a little kid, you remember your grandmothers from a different size. But I mean, I remember like their nylons. They were like a mid-calf nylon or something. You went up halfway. You look at that thing. That's interesting. You know, it's tough, but that's grandma. You know, and that's how it was. And their shoes. I remember my grandmother's shoes. I don't know why, again, you're down that size, so you see shoes, I guess, a lot. But, I mean, they didn't have any of these real feminine high-heeled, little pointy little things. Or, you know, stuff. My grandmother had the biggest, like army shoes. I mean, these things were like surplus store, you know, military-grade black shoes. The heels on them were, I mean, huge heels. I mean, gigantic things. I mean, she could fall over in those shoes. They'd pull her back up or something. They were just, but, you know, stabilize her shoes, you know, or something. But they were old people. And they got old, and it was okay. There was no pressure. They were happy. I could have never, ever, ever dreamed of coming over to my grandmother's house. Hi, Grandma, walking in the door, and have her on there, some exercise tape. Grandpa's coming home. I can't get ready for Grandpa. You know, they were old. It was okay to get old. And then, and again, the world, you can't stop the world on its, what it's trying to do. But a husband can. A husband can look at his wife and say, honey, I love you. And I love you just the way you are. And we're getting old together, and we're going to be who we are together, and whatever it is. I love you. And maybe whatever it was that attracted us to each other years ago, there may be little bits and pieces of that left, but it's going. Let it go. Because what I've discovered under the skin is more precious to me than the skin. And when there's something there that people realize that, and that's where we want to go, and that's what we want to have, that's when somebody can, and they accept, and they love, and they adore, and they and who they are, and what they do. You're my mate. We're not perfect, but our love is going to be perfect, and our care for one another is going to be perfect. I heard a story once of this woman who was married to this very hard-to-please man. No matter what she did, it was never good enough. Always she fell short. And one day she gets up and she prays. She said, Lord, today I'm just going to do, I'm going to be the perfect wife. I'm going to do whatever it is. And she just got so excited, and she comes in, there's her husband reading the paper. She says, darling, what would you like for breakfast this morning? He pulls the paper back, looks at her, and he says, I want two eggs. One scrambled, the other over easy. And I want bacon crisp, sausage. And I want toast black, and coffee black, and grits, I want grits. She's so cute, darling. I'll go fix it. She goes in and she cooks the eggs, one scrambled, one over easy, and she gets the bacon crisp, and she gets the sausage, and she gets the grits, and she gets the toast black, and she gets the black steaming coffee, and she gets it all there, and she comes, she slides it there, you know, under his paper there. You know, here it is, honey. Here's your breakfast. He pulls it back, the paper back. He looks at that, stares at it a moment, and he says, well, I'll be if you didn't scramble the wrong egg. And some people, you'll never please them. Some people, it's almost like they've got to find something wrong. But when somebody washes and cleanses, they look there and they're amazed. Why would you even cook for me? Why? I mean, why would you even, why do you even care for me? Why did you do this? Why isn't there arsenic in it? I deserve arsenic in my food, you know, or something. They should be amazed that this person loves and cares and adores. And then he says, not only there that you sanctify and you cleanse, but he says you wash with the word. There, the God looks there, I believe, at the man, and part of being head is that he's not just simply the head of the marriage. He's the head spiritually. He is the one there that the word of God is in their life. It's in their home. It's in their family because that's his role. That's his job. And not to say oftentimes, many times it's the women are there with the kids, sending them off to school, and has maybe more time and a little prayer when they get here or there or whatever else. And, you know, the husbands have different schedules maybe. But there is something to me that when the family knows that dad is the spiritual head of this home, we go to church because my dad is a man of God. We are who we are because my dad. My mom, maybe she's carrying out a lot of the stuff, and she certainly has her roles in it. And she gets us up, and we're off to Sunday school. But we're there because my dad is a man of God. I think kids, when they're on home, and they realize there that their mom is the spiritual leader, she's the one doing the influence, she's the one that's nagging and pushing, you got an uphill battle. And oftentimes, kids rebel. But when people look in there, they realize the dad is the one. He looks there, and you can see it in his eyes. Yeah, I got jobs to do. We got food to put on the table. We got clothes. Do we got to get? We got a house and a roof to put over our head, and we've got all this. But above all else, the reason we have it is because God made us, and we're before Him. And there's the word. There's the priesthood there that goes on. And Paul says there, I mean, these simple things. He said, but again, we don't by nature get this. Many times, I think, because women tend to be more spiritual. Women tend to be more aware of things. I don't know why that is. I wish it wasn't, I suppose. But I think it's true. And God looks there, and that's why He has to say to the husband, they're sanctifier and cleanser. And take that role. You are the priest of the house. See that the word is there. That is your job. Now carry it on. Because we wouldn't naturally do that. We have to be taught, just like the wife has to say, submit to Him. Truly submit to Him. In the Spirit. Not just a game. And we're both of them. They're learning that. But then he says to the husband, if you will do this. He then says to him, he says that he might present to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. And then he says, so ought men to love their wives as their own body. He says, he that loves his wife loves himself. And now Paul gives us this tremendous test of tremendous illustration. When a man says, I love my wife, I do these, then Paul says, great. Now I got a little test here for you. A little, you know, way to evaluate. Husbands, do you love your wife like you love your own body? He says, for no man ever yet hated his flesh, but he nourishes it and he cherishes it, even as the Lord of the church. Just the same way that when the Lord says, I love the church, he says, that's the same way, husbands, you are with your very own body. And now, do you treat your wife the way you treat your own body? Do you get that? And the interesting thing is how we are with our own body. You know, for example, maybe this morning you woke up, and when you woke up there, you realize there through the last 8 hours, your body perspires. You maybe woke up over near your armpit. Whoa, man, what happened there? And then you inhale and you breathe. You're like, man, I think a dead rat climbed in my mouth overnight, you know, or whatever, and you stink. But what do? You just get up. You walk into the bathroom, you go turn on the shower, turn on the water, you know, just let it go for a minute till you get the hot and the cold just right. Put your hand in there till it's the perfect, comfortable, just, you know, temperature. And then you go and you climb in there into the shower and, you know, and get some soap, maybe even sing, you know, while you're doing it, taking your shower. And then you step out and then you go look in the mirror and there's this stubble that came overnight, you know, that grew there. Pull out the shaver. You know, go on and you start and you shave and you clean your chin up there and you get yourself kind of all ready. You love your body. You take care of it. You watch over, you know, the body. You didn't get up this morning and smell that. Say, you stinking body. I'm so sick and tired of you stinking. Every day you stink again. What do? I clean you and why? Why do I keep cleaning you? You're just going to go out and stink again. You know, you go turn it on boiling hot in there and say, you know something? I'm teaching you a lesson. I'm sick and tired of your stinking body. You're going in there and I'm burning it. You're going to learn. No, you go in there. You take care of your body. You know, you wash it. But how do we treat our wife when she fails? How do we treat our wife when there's something there that's not perfect there? How do we, you know, do we find ourselves, what, you know, are we upset, you know, with it? When you look in the mirror and hear that your face needs to be shaved again. It just needs to be shaved. So you shave the thing. You didn't get mad. You'd sit there at your face just like, you stinking face. Look at you. I shave you every stinking day. I'm sick and tired. You're stubble, 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 stubble. No, you just clean it and shave it. But when our wife has a need, honey, I need $20. We do, what? What did you say? I need $20. That's what I thought you said. I'll tell you what. Here, what do you think I am? What do you think I am? A money tree? I'll tell you what. Here, all shaking. You just pick it all up. Whatever falls, it's yours. You know, I'm just like, you need $20. What did you do with the $20 I gave you last month? You haven't even turned in the notarized receipts for that, and now you want me to give you more? What is the deal? No wonder we're broke. You know, I mean, and some, but yet at the same time, we, it's fishing season, or there's a hunting season, or we need a new tires for our 4x4 or whatever. Oh boy, we got the money for that. We find a way to do stuff for our own flesh. But here Paul says, no, the thing there, to learn there to love your wife as your own body. No man ever yet hateth in his own flesh. He nourishes, he takes care of it. He loves to take care of it. We love to watch, take care of our body. We're going to take a break here in a few minutes and you'll go out to lunch. That's the plan, I think. And you'll probably go into a restaurant. And if you're anything like me and you go out to lunch, are we going out to lunch? Nice restaurant? Really nice? Not so? Medium. Okay. Well, I just want to put you on the spot here, a little pressure. But at any rate, because I want to go out to a restaurant, and I want to sit there with that, and I want to look at that menu, and I want to take time on it. I want to sit there, and I'm going to give me a little time here. Yesterday, James took us to a place, and we got whatever that stuff was, where you pocket full of cheese in a little, I mean, unbelievable. Cheese and butter in a, what was that, James? God bless you. But I mean, it was just, there's something about, you go in and you open a thing and then you want to meditate on it. And you meditate. What you're doing is you're carrying on this whole conversation for 10 minutes with you and your tummy. You're just thinking, okay, what do you want? And I'll ask you a question. What about that? And it was, well, that's a little spicy. And then you just, no, it's spicy. You can't take the spicy. Remember the spicy last night? Yeah. Okay, no. Well, let's move on to the next thing. And you kind of go through and you'll have this whole conversation with your tummy till the tummy comes back. Bingo! That's it. Give that a shot. And then you turn there and you say, give me that. You know, or whatever. And because you love nourishing, cherishing, taking care of your flesh. And having this whole, just over a meal over the thing. You know, you'll sit there, maybe you walked in, there was a piece of chocolate cake in the entry thing, in a little glass thing. You say, hey, that cake, yeah. What, that cake, do you know that cake? Yeah. That's called chocolate decadence. I want one. Yeah, hold it for me. My body wants that. But I mean, nothing too good for our own flesh. But when we look there, Paul says, nourish and cherish her. She is. You see, the amazing thing about us, that when God created us, God created Adam, he was a complete being. He then took part of him out, woman, out of man. Immediately, when Adam woke up and he looked at her, he didn't need any discussion, any education. He looked, he says, behold, she is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. He knew something was wrong, something was missing, but he immediately knew it's right there. And so what Adam was like before Adam, Eve was taken out, we'll never know. But there was something there that was now in her. And he looked over, and I'm convinced every man, if he could not take his wife, and if he could pull her right inside, he would. Because she came from there. Because she is the rest of his body. And now Paul says, a husband's to learn there to love her as your own body. He that loves his wife loves himself. Because one day, if you do that, you will present to yourself a glorious church. A spotless church. An incredible church. And it'll be your reward. It'll be something there when it comes back, you know, to you, what you will get in return for it. It will be incredible. When we first got married, we hadn't been married too long, and I had been on staff at Calvary and Costa Mesa. I had wanted to start a Bible college and found a facility up in Twin Peaks. Convinced Chuck Smith and the board to do it, and so they bought it, and I went up to start the Bible college. When we went up looking for a house, we found a house that was actually going up for auction one night, for a public auction there, and I decided, Jean loved the house, she wanted a lot, and it was fine with me. I decided I think we could work it. And now, I don't know, I'm a Scotsman. I don't see many Scotsmen around here. I know a lot of you wish you were Scotsmen. I'm sorry, there's only so many. But I don't know what you know about Scotsmen, but we're known to be tight. And in fact, my motto is where there's a will, I want to be in it. But I mean, something there. But the Scotsman, you're tight. Well, I'm looking there at this house and trying to figure out my dad. My degree was in business. My dad's a businessman. My dad and I, we sit down and figure out on this auction, how much could we pay? Because when it goes up for public auction, you know, you bid. And so we're trying to figure out, well, she wants it. And so we're figure a maximum bid. Okay, at this point, we can afford it, pull it off. If it's going to be more, got to bail. Well, the night that the auction was, I couldn't go. I had a speaking engagement there that I had to go to, but my mom and dad said, hey, we'll take Gene and the kids up. We'll go do it, you know, for you and handle the whole thing. And we put in $1,000 cashier's check to be a part of the thing. And so our name was entered. And so my dad goes up to represent me. I go off to speak, do my thing. When I come home, they're already back. And as soon as I walked in the door, it was obvious we got the house because Gene, I could hear her singing. You know, I got the house. We got the house. We got the house, you know, through the house. She's quite excited. So I come walking and I find her and I said, so we got the house. Yeah, we got the house, we got the house. And of course, what was my first question? How much? That's really obviously. So I said, how much was it? And she said, I don't know. That's between you and your dad. He took care of all that. He's in the other room. And so I go in, there's my mom and dad still there. And I said, so we got it. She said, yeah, we got it. He said, well, how much was it? And then he proceeds to tell me. And it was more than we agreed on. And I'm there. My dad could even realize I'm a little startled. And he's looking at me and he's staring at me. And I'm kind of waiting, you know, for what, like a little shock. And he says, yeah, you got it. And then he could read my confusion. And he says, Don, can I give you a little advice? And I'm thinking I need advice and money. You know, on it and things. And he didn't offer any money, but he did advice. He said, Don, let me tell you something. He that has a happy wife has a happy wife. And he just looks at me. And he says, whatever that costs you, pay it. Because the alternative is very expensive. Now I'll tell you, I'm not for, I mean, I believe there's definite limits and there's a lot of people can do very foolish things. But the import of the thing where a husband is to be able to look at his wife, say within boundaries of wisdom, and by the way, God did bless us and that house went up very well, and it wasn't a whole lot more that I paid for it, and it turned out to be a tremendous blessing and investment for us. But the point was, is that my dad was looking at me and said, Don, you know, she is your joy in life. Taking care of her would be a joy in life. And you can make this. You can work this. You know, on this thing. And you need to learn to do that. And it's not just simply the economic aspect. It's the attitude. It's the spirit of life. You realize, I am here. God has put me here to want to be a vessel through which your life would be blessed and encouraged and strengthened. And we don't naturally think that way. And God has to teach us that, you know, of loving her as Christ of the church, of looking at her and really realizing she is my body. When I am nourishing her, I am nourishing myself. I am one day presenting back to myself this incredible reward, this joy, this crown that I will have, that I'm so glad I invested in, however I did, whatever the investment was, time, energy, process, expense, whatever, to say, you are the chief person that it's to go to, that I want to help with. And sadly, you know, by nature, we don't love that way. We're kind of like the story I heard of this couple on our 50th anniversary, and they'd never seemingly been happy. They'd raised children together, had a bunch of kids and things, but the mother, she was just a wonderful woman, but the dad was just a stick in the mud. Just a never a happy man, never a good marriage. And for the 50th anniversary, the kids got together and decided, you know something, we're giving mom and dad some marriage counseling series, you know, of appointments for their anniversary present. And so they get this young psychiatrist, married psychiatrist, you know, that they go pay for these series and, you know, for him and for them to go to help their marriage. Well, so they go. And so as they're going to these appointments, they go in and the wife, they got a young psychiatrist, he's talking to them, testing them, doing things. The first one, he kind of realizes the mom's real tender, real sweet, real open, trying to get some help. Meantime, he just sits back staring like, what am I doing here? I don't need this. You know, but they go through the thing. Second appointment, she opens up, weeps a little bit. He tries to get this guy to soften. Nothing happens. What am I doing here? I'm not interested. I'm here, but I'm not here. You know, and it goes one after another. And this guy, meantime, he's calling his old professor. He's calling his buddies, anybody, breakthrough with this couple. He's wonderful things with her, nothing with him. And it's going appointment after appointment. He realizes he's not succeeding. There's not even the slightest response in this guy. It finally comes down to the last appointment. The guy feels like a total failure as a counselor. Young guy, wanted so well to succeed, and he can't get anywhere. And he's so frustrated after, you know, all these appointments. The woman's so sweet and tender and everything. She responds, he didn't. And finally, out of frustration, they're getting up at the last moment. Okay, I'm sorry I couldn't help you folks. But all of a sudden, at the last minute, he looks over at the husband. And he says to him, he says, you know, son, I want to try something. He says, what's that? He says to the wife, he says, come here. Come over here. So she gets up and walks over. He says, looks at her, he says, I'm going to do something, and I want you to watch me. I want you to watch me. Will you do that? He says, yeah, sure, whatever. And he takes this wife. He takes this gal, puts his arm around her, puts his hand behind her back, bends her over. And this young psychiatrist and this woman who had been married for 50, he lays a kiss on her lips like she never felt. I mean, he just holds her there and embraces her and he kisses her and holds her there and he pulls her back up and her eyes are kind of spinning a little bit. And then he looks over at the guy and he says, did you see what just happened? He said, yeah, I saw that. And he says, this woman, she needs this at least 3 times a week. Do you get that? The fellow looks at her and he says, I'll have her here Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But a lot of guys, they just don't get it. They don't realize God says, you are the vessel. You are the one that I put here for you to love her and you to care. And like I say, women, they struggle with submission. Husbands, that's why, I mean, these are in, God doesn't teach us in the Bible to breathe because we'll figure it out somewhere. Eat, sleep. You know, things we'll learn in nature, but the things that God says, no, you don't get this until you learn it from me. And whether it's wife submitting or husband loving. And when we can learn that and say, God, truly teach me that. I want that. I heard a story one day of, you know, the Lord came into the garden and he looks at Adam. And he says, you know, Adam, it's not good that man should be alone. He said, oh, I want to make a helpmate for you. What's that? A wife. What's that? He said, oh, Adam, incredible. An incredible plan I got here. He says, a woman. And he says, and what's that? And he says, well, he said, first of all, he says, she'll be a homemaker. You need a homemaker. And when I mean homemaker, I mean homemaker. She'll do, you know, the foundation, rough plumbing, roofing, electrical. She'll build a house. A phenomenal home builder for you. And a cook. I mean, Adam, she'll be an unbelievable cook. German food, French, Italian, Mexican, Chinese, Japanese, Hungarian, Connors, everything. Incredible cook for you. This is where before there were any Hungarians or Germans or Russians or anything. She'll be able to cook it all for you. And then the yard, gardener. She'll love gardening. She'll love the yard. Man, she'll take your yard. There won't be a weed in it. She'll trim the hedges like little animals and things. It'll be like you live in a park. The grass will be beautiful. I mean, she'll just be incredible and a lover. Oh, I mean, an unbelievable lover. Give you beautiful, beautiful, gorgeous, wonderful children. And Adam said, he says, wow, I like that. And he says, I want that, yeah. And he says, but Lord, he says, what'll that cost? And he said, well, a model like that, it'll cost you an arm and a leg. And he thinks for a moment, he says, oh, boy. Well, what can I get for a rib? And the point of it is, in life, is that you kind of get what you pay for. Somebody that wants to get by cheap is going to get cheap. And one of the things, when a husband loves his wife as Christ loves the church, he says, I'll pay whatever for my bride. I'll live, I'll die, I'll intercede, I'll present faultless. I'll watch over her, I'll care, I'll forgive, I'll cleanse. I'll never stop. I'll go to the cross, die, be raised from the dead, come back and love her again. I'll give an arm and a leg and a body to have her. I don't care the price. And I think when we as men, we look there and you know, and sometimes in a relationship, we want to know how cheap we can get by. And then we wonder why we're upset with what we get. But when we look there and the Lord says, you love her as I love the church. It's expensive, but it'll be the best you ever spent on anything. And what you'll get back out of it you'll grow old with and happy with. Amen? Heard a lot of women on that, but that's okay. But anyway, Father, thank you for today, and I just pray that you would teach us. Lord, we come before you, and we just admit we're sinners. And Lord, I pray that you would help us hear through our own ears. And not that we're sitting there saying, oh, Lord, I hope they heard that. That won't do no good at all. But Lord, when we can be praying, did I hear? Lord, that each woman can say, Lord, you take care of him, but please take care of me. Did I hear? And each man can say, Lord, did I hear? I want this. I want to present to myself a glorious church. I want to end up my life like this. Lord, help us and teach us and strengthen us. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.